Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Even if you don't have it already written, you just go in the booth and let the music take you there.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 204, a talk with Stevie Stone. Stevie is an MC who is part of the Strange Music family. However, his gravelly voice and powerful vision make him stand out even among that talented crew. Stevie started out signed to Eazy-E's Ruthless Records, but quickly joined the Strange family. An appropriate move since, for his very first show, he shared the stage with the label's co-founder and flagship artist, Tech N9ne. Since then, Stevie has made a series of great and often experimental albums, including 2015's Malta Bend, which explored his mother's childhood in the small Missouri town of that name. His new album, out Friday, June 2nd, is called Level Up. If you enjoyed The Cypher, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. It helps us keep the lights on, and we've recently updated our rewards with some crazy new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cypher. And now, here's the guy who put Malta Bend on the map, Stevie Stone. So, and we should tell you before we start up that hiding in the back there is Josh's son, who has a day off from school because his allergies were acting up. So Miles, you can come out and say hi. This is
how
Miles.
My sisters, they need help with the multiplication tables. So.
Yeah. Have you listened? Y'all heard that, the multiplication rap.
Remember these rhymes. You gotta know math if you want to survive. When it comes to the zero, you will be a hero. Zero times a number is zero. Now you have to one. You got a done, cause one times any number's just that number. Starting with the two, listen to the beat. Sing along and tap your feet. Two times two is always four. Now
you will learn some. Yeah. So what is the story behind multiplication?
Well, this was like when I was in St. Louis. I just got a production deal. No, I didn't even have a production deal at the time. I was just hungry in the studio working, grinding. And a third grade math teacher came in and she was like, yo, I want to do X, Y, Z. I'm going to pay you for it. I was broke. It's crazy. And we did it. You know what I mean? As far as the actual table, she did that. I wrote the beginning part. The multiplication rap, remember these lines. Hey, kids, remember these lines. This is before any deal or anything. It's just grinding, hungry.
Yeah.
And in St. Louis, a third grade math teacher came to me and asked me to do it. Frizz did the beat. We was in there grinding, you know what I'm saying? Both got a few hundred dollars a piece and we recorded
it. And it lives on. It's still on Spotify.
So, yes. It's on I hear it's on a lot of things. And you know, it's crazy. I've had people, teachers, math teachers and things come to shows and tell me we use this in our class.
Wow.
Huge fans. I've had kids that learned their math off of that and tell me like, yo, I learned my math off of you. You know what I mean? So anything for the kids. I look at it. I don't look at it as anything bad. I think it's definitely positive.
Nice. Well, maybe we'll have a sequel down the road for Division or something.
We'll see. I don't know about that right, you know, anymore.
Right.
But
right. Yeah. But starting kind of back there, I wanted to dig into, you know, you're getting started and growing up. You grew up in kind of rural Missouri, right? Columbia,
Missouri.
Were there any rappers from your area that you remember growing up even before you moved to St. Louis?
Yes, there was some. There was a group called The Underworld when I was young.
Do you well represent a bunch of hardcore brothers coming straight from the city? The city, I mean, St. Louis, Columbia, Sedalia, and Kansas City. We come here to let you know
that Missouri has some brothers that can
flow. Boston Avenue, a couple of blocks from Frostwood, next to Independence Park. Yeah, it's all good. Home where the Hoopers play, where the players make their pay, where the hustlers...
They has some success, like they toured with Roger Troutman, Zappin' Roger.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. But we didn't have anybody that really did too much, you know, garage, basements, recording and everything like that. But the Underworld, when I was young, that was the people that we looked up to because they did the most. They had a CD out.
Mm-hmm.
Even back then, groups didn't even have an actual CD that's in a poster and everything. That was super big. But there wasn't too many people in Columbia that actually did it and took it super serious. It was more like hobbies for people and everything right. like that.
Yeah. Then you moved to St. Louis. What year did you end up moving there?
I moved to St. Louis, I believe, like 05.
So that was after Nelly broke. And so were you close enough to St. Louis that Nelly breaking 2000-ish was a big deal to you? You were like 18, 19 when that happened?
Yeah, I was still in high school.
Yeah.
It was dope. Like when Nelly hit the down, down, baby, you're speeding it.
Come on.
Everybody, you know, that was like an anthem.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also gave a lot of people with music aspirations confidence that it could happen. We knew St. Louis was a bigger city. So from Columbia to St. Louis, about like an hour and a half,
mm-hmm.
Both ways. An hour and a half to St. Louis and an hour and a half to like Kansas City. So Columbia's like this smack in the middle. But when Nelly did that, everybody knew who Nelly was.
Nice. So you had kind of two paths as a kid. You played basketball pretty seriously. You were going to go to school for it.
Yes, sir.
And you were doing music, playing piano and drums.
Yes, sir.
So did you think of either of them as potential careers? Were they both stuff you did for fun? How did you think about both those things
basketball
when you were growing
up? Basketball was my super passion now. I thought all the time I was going to go and play college ball, go play NBA. That was on everything I wanted. Sports, real sports junkie, football, basketball. But basketball was my first love.
Yeah.
Loved music though. Grew up around music. My mother played the piano. My father, singers, you know what I mean? I played, you know, instruments. So I loved it more as a hobby. You know what I'm saying? Just loved to do it. But I would create too. I'd be in my room, have my keyboard. I would be creating beats and creating songs and things like that. But once I did the show,
right.
and that's when it all clicked. It was like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I want to do.
Yeah. So tell me about that. There was a concert. You were like 2 weeks away from going to college.
Yes.
And
full ride, full scholarship. And I did the show and I never looked back.
So what was it about the show that clicked for you? Can you put it into words?
You know, you hear the story, but like you got the bug. It's like you just know. Something just clicked in my mind. It's like, I know that I want to do this.
Mm.
I know that I want to entertain for the people. I love to perform. And that's what it was. I was able to perform. Tech N9ne was actually on that show.
Right.
This was the same day that Tech N9ne and Travis O'Gwen formed Strange Music. They decided they were going to form Strange Music on this same show.
Wow.
And I was just one of the youngsters that was just opening up. And it just hit me.
So your little 10-minute set or whatever it was.
I can't explain the feeling. I just knew that I wasn't going to go play basketball.
Wow.
I knew it right then. When I got off the stage, I'm like, this is what I'm going to do.
Wow. And how did your family react when you didn't leave for college?
Well, my father, and you know, I don't know if you know, but my father was a bishop. He was a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in Iowa. He was a little hurt, you know. He was like, music, you got a full scholarship ride. Are you sure that's what you want to do? My mom just like, whatever you feel like that you wanted to do. My mom was like, for me, whichever way that I want to go. And, you know, both of them is positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? They know me, whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to get lost in it. I'm going to do it to the fullest. So my mom was like, go for it, you know. And my father gave me some words, but he accepted it, and I was there.
Nice. And so you start recording. I know you have a bunch of sort of early collaboration stuff. Who were some of the people you were working with when you first started out?
When I first started recording,
yeah,
I was in a garage recording, and just a bunch of the homies from Columbia, Chance and Apex and Big Mike, Bobby Doss and Lil Bunky. We had like a bunch of us. The same people that we was at the show with. There's probably like 13 of us. Wow. When we met Tech, at the show. There was like 13 of us. And we was just young and hungry and would go, like, some people were doing it just for hobbies. Mm-hmm. And me too, I think at the time, until that show, I knew that I really wanted to do it. But we was just recording in a garage on 8-track, and only 6 of the tracks worked. So just think about it, you got 13 people recording on a tape. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so the beats got to get
at least 2
on 2 tracks, and you got the other 13 people on the other 4 tracks. You know what I mean? So it took some creativity.
Right.
But our engineer, his name is Duck, Lil Ducky.
Oh, yeah. What's up? It's Lil Duck in the house.
He had a little production company. Not for real, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah. They called it Ninja D Productions. And he was actually a DJ who had a name. He was a battler, scratcher, and everything. And, you know, big props to him because he gave me a light to go and produce. I remember when I first came in the studio, because I played the piano. Everybody knew I played the piano. I played the drums and everything like that. So my boy Apex brought me in. Ducky was just like, there was a TS-10. TS-10 is like this keyboard. You know, you can make the beats and do everything on there. And they was just like, yeah. Make a beat. I'm like I know how to make a beat, but I don't know how to track. I don't know how to do anything. So my boy Apex took me through track, did the drums, boom, boom. And that's how I started. You know what I'm saying? And I ended up being like one of the main producers at that time for all the people that were coming around. You know what I mean? And I was more on beats and rapping at then. You know what I'm saying? Over time, I backed off the production so I can get better with my writing and concepts and everything like that, you know?
Yeah. And so some of the earliest stuff that I've heard from you that's out there is probably like 07, 08, right around the time of the multiplication rap
that
we were talking about.
Yes, sir.
Early stuff like Wait a Minute and things like that.
Wait a minute, hold your horses, Steve's told up in the town. Wait a minute, give me four mic and I'ma shut it down. Wait a minute.
There's a big Southern rap influence on some of this. And throughout your career, I think it's very apparent on some of that early stuff. So
definitely.
What kind of Southern rap were you listening to? Is that what was popular in Missouri?
Man, I just grew up. That's when I signed with Ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about Wait a Minute. So that's the New Kid Coming album.
There are a couple other early things. I'm a Rider.
Cut it loose, why stop you in the shot, swing at the starting point, check the fast again, being waiting.
Wow. Yeah. So NASCAR, that was a NASCAR song.
Mm-hmm.
So what that was, there was he's a NASCAR driver right now, a good friend of mine named Carl Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually from Columbia, Missouri.
Oh.
And you know, me and his brother Kenny Edwards was really good friends. And he became very successful at NASCAR, and there's a lot of people at that point in time, you know, in the town, you know, we had a lot of people that were talented around us. And he just wanted to create a way for people in the town to do some music. And he actually tried to sign me because he had a record company at the time. But I was actually in the process of getting a production deal in St. Louis, like third quarter of, you know what I'm saying? They already gave me paperwork, just trying to iron everything out. So I didn't sign, but I did the compilation with him.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's the CD or whose CD?
Yeah.
Sean is talking about the 2007 compilation, that one CD put out by Edwards label Back 40 Records.
So if you see, there's a whole bunch of people up on there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I just went ahead and was a part of the compilation and everything. And dope. So that I'm a Rider was actually a NASCAR song.
Oh.
If you listen to the lyrics, like I'm talking about NASCAR antics and things like that. You know what I mean?
Your voice on that is different. I mean, obviously it was a while ago, but it's different. It's not quite as gravelly as it is now. What do you hear when you're going back and listen to that stuff from 06, 07?
Whatever? Young Stevie.
Yeah.
Young Stevie. You know, I think each year my voice gets stronger mm-hmm. and stronger. And keep getting better and better and better. So when I hear the old stuff, it's like, whoa. Young. I just see young. It sounds young. It's more fuller now, I guess. You know, back then I felt it was more lighter. That's what I think when I listen.
Yeah. And so you mentioned the Ruthless deal. You have your first album, New Kid Coming, is on Ruthless.
Yes, sir.
Before we get into details of that, how'd you get hooked up with Ruthless in the first place?
Okay. I was in St. Louis, got my production deal with this company called Fly Moves Productions. And that was Fly Moves at the time had a studio called Fat Buddha. And this was like the premier studio in St. Louis. So anybody that come in from out of town was going to this studio, like all the major artists. So your Lil Wayne's, Fantasia's, Bubba Sparks, anybody that was popping, even Nelly was recording there. Murphy Lee, Lunatics, everybody was coming to this spot to record. And they offered me a production deal. And at the time, it was Mike Landau, Brad Goldenberg, and then Ira DeWitt. Ira DeWitt was the wife of the owner of the Cardinals.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they put together Fly Moose Production, and they gave me a production deal. It's like, just come up here and just record. Don't even think about getting signed. We're just going to keep on going. You know, hopefully you get signed in a couple of years, X, Y, and Z. So we just went up there with the work ethic and just doing what I love to do anyway in the studio. Countless. I remember getting up in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, be at the studio, stay all night, go to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning in the studio. When they come back to the studio, I wake up, brush my teeth, boom, and then we back at it again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But end up getting accepted to go down to Atlanta to do this Hip Hop and Billboard's showcase. They picked a certain amount of rappers and a certain amount of R&B. It was a Hip Hop and R&B. And I was one of the rappers that they chose. So I went down there, and it was like a needle in a haystack. My CD, you know, when you go to the conferences and stuff, you have the CDs that come in the bag, and everybody gets the bag.
Right, and there's a track. It's like a compilation CD.
A million CDs from everybody that's there. So it's like 200, 300 CDs in each bag that everybody's getting for new music.
Yeah.
And Tamika, which is Easy's wife, rest in peace, Easy, she heard the CD. And it was actually a mixtape of mine, Hemi Hine, Volume 1. And she ended up running into Ira. And then they started talking, you know, just casually talking. And Ira was like, so who are you feeling down here? And then Tamika was like, I'm feeling this dude named Stevie Stone. And then Ira was like, well, that's who I'm down here. That's my artist I'm representing. And that's how I started. I met her. Then she told me she liked it. Ira had a birthday party like about 2 or 3 weeks later. And Tamika said, I remember she was like, I was like, you know, I want you to come to my birthday party. She was like, can Stevie perform? She was like, absolutely, Stevie will perform. And so she flew in. She flew in. Her and Jason Winborn, they flew in. And I performed. And she came up right afterwards and was like, yo, I want to sign you. I want to hear some more of your stuff. I want to, you know, X, Y, and Z. So that Monday, we ended up sending her like 10 tracks. She was like, I love 5 of them. Send me some more. And we sent her like another 5. And then she was like, okay, I want to come down and watch you record and write on the spot in the studio. And then I want to see your show. So we booked a show in St. Louis, Blueberry Hill, down in the Loop in St. Louis. It's a historic spot.
Mm-hmm.
She came down. I recorded on the spot, wrote and recorded on the spot. That night, I did the show. She came up to me after. It was like, you got a deal, you know what I mean? It still took a little bit of time for the paperwork and everything. Yeah. I even was discouraged, like, oh, man. I done told my mama I was about to get a deal. It's like 6 months later. I still ain't got the deal, but it came. That was my first deal.
Wow. So you're joining Ruthless, obviously a label that whatever it may or may not have been up to in 2008, 2009, has this storied history,
yes,
of which the intro of the record refers to, right? It has N.W.A. and D.O.C. and so forth.
Eazy-E, N.W.A., MC Ren, Above the Law, D.O.C., J.J. Fag, Michelle, Bone Thugs and Harmony, and now presenting the new Kid.
What was it like to be joining a label with that in its back catalog?
Humbling, honored.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, without N.W.A. and Ruthless Records, who know what hip-hop would be today?
Right.
You know what I mean? That's how I looked at it. And I felt it was just, at that point, they was once the number one independent record label in the world, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying, and how big that they got. So there was so much history there with Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, you know, and to be able to follow those footsteps, that's anybody's dream, you know what I'm saying? That's hip-hop, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was wonderful, wonderful feeling.
And you were there the same time as Hobson, more or less?
Ooh, yeah. I'm here, so open up the door for me. Who is it? It's Hobson.
Hobson signed to Ruthless in 2007 and released one album with the label, 2009's Gazing at the Moonlight. After leaving Ruthless, he started his own label, Funk Volume.
We pretty much got signed together and kind of left at the same time, mm-hmm. too.
What was he like back then?
Hobson's always been super talented, you know what I mean? Even back then, he was doing his own video treatments and making his own beats and recording himself. And he was always been a jack of all trades, you know what I'm saying? That's one thing I remember even back then. Hobson was just super, super talented mm-hmm. and did everything himself. You know, like I said, he did his own videos, shot his own videos, made his own beats, rapped, played the key. You know what I'm saying?
He did. No wonder he started his own label.
He was just doing everything himself. Super talented guy.
On that record, the song Hatin' has a little dig at a manager. You don't say anyone's name, but a manager who says like can't manage his own money.
What type of manager can't manage his own spending?
Was that a shot at someone specific?
Yeah.
Tell me a little about the situation.
There was a guy that, when I was up and coming, old high school friend of mine, he came in to start managing me. And he just did some very dishonest things. And, music is therapy. And I had to get it out. So that's what that was.
Okay. Do you know if he ever heard it?
Of course he heard it. Of course he heard it. Yeah, he heard it.
Yeah. And also on that album, there's a song with George Clinton.
Yeah.
Which is nuts.
Words get in the way when you try to say it. Can you feel me?
Ready or not, Stevie Stone.
What it is, man?
Let's do it again.
Were you in the room with him?
No, but I'd love to tell you the story.
Yeah, please.
So I'm going to take it all the way. It's called Red Wine. The song's called Red Wine.
Yeah.
So my production team, they had this wine bottle that they hadn't opened like in 10 years. I think his mother got it like in Peru or something like that. 1855 was divine. It was Philip Rothschild. I can't remember the type of the wine it was, but it was something like that.
Yeah.
It was definitely Rothschild. I do remember that. And we just up here working hard. You know, we got the deal, working on the album and stuff like that. Spirits is high. So it was late night. Everybody was at the studio. I'm like, man, crack that. I've never drank wine before. I was like, man, I've never drank wine. Crack. And he was like, man, I haven't been opened up in 10 years. I said, well, this is the best time to do it right now. Hopefully it might spark something. So he pops it open. And I drank like a half a glass, get tipsy. And my boy Frizz, County Boy Frizz, which is my hype man now and still producing with me, he did this beat. And instantly I heard the George Clinton. You know,
ready or not, ready or not, here we come, getting down on the one which we believe in.
So I just flipped it, you know what I'm saying? Love the way you carry on, getting tipsy over here, we're sipping red, red wine. Just unwind.
Carry on. We're getting tipsy over her. We're sipping red, red wine. Just unwind. Bring your body all night long. And let me whisper in your ear. We're sipping. What up, Mossy?
You know what I'm saying? I just flipped it up and talked about the wine, but I'm also talking about me and a female together kicking it and still giving my love, my newfound love for red wine that I'm feeling really good about. So it instantly came to me. I started writing it. Like the hook got done there. I think a couple of days later, we tracked it. The chief engineer at the studio's fiance was a part of George Clinton's tour manager. He was his tour manager.
Oh.
Nobody knew this. He never did say anything or nothing. So I didn't even know this. And next thing you know, I come in the studio. He gets it, cleans it up, sends it to his girl's people. Is like, yo, let George hear it. Just let George hear this. You know what I'm saying? We're doing this. You know what I'm saying? Just want to hear it. So I got back to the studio probably like a few days later. And they called me in the office like, yo, George wants to hop on the record. I'm like, what? Like, we didn't even ask him. He heard it, loved it, and offered to hop on the record. And that's what happened. I didn't get to record it with him. He was in Moscow at the time, touring. You know, another thing, I'm going to tell you something else that not many people know. I was this close of getting Sly Stone to play the guitar on there also. This was the first time that George Clinton and Sly Stone had ever been in the studio together. Them boys was in Moscow together in the studio going. And they called us like, we can get Sly. And I wish my management and everything would have just pushed the button, because that would have really been super epic. But we didn't get Sly, but we did get George. You know what I mean? That's the story about that.
One of the things that stuck out on that album is, especially for a debut album, right, for someone so early in their career, the hooks are really strong.
It's me and my team, spoiled by the best of the jolly good game. The best cushion in the loo, train wreck, blueberry, cotton candy too.
And so I guess I was just wondering how you thought about hooks, how you learned to write hooks.
Oh, no. I wrote every hook on there, too. It's just, you know, at that point in time, too, it's like I lived in the studio. I was a studio lab rat. So every morning, every night, I'm in there, I'm listening, I'm grinding, I'm becoming one with the music. You know, when you get lost in a beat, when you get lost in the music, it's just, it comes. Yeah. You know, as more and more time comes, see, back then it was like, okay, when we wasn't worried about the price of studio, because the production company had the studio and we're just in there, and it was just like, do what you do, you know what I mean? No time limit, you know what I mean? So it was just like work. And that's what we did every day, all day.
Right. But hook writing is a different skill than writing verses.
Definitely. I don't know. I mean, I love to write hooks, you know, even still to this day. I mean, I love doing hooks. On this new album, I didn't do as many. I kind of stepped back off of it and took up.
You had some other singers.
Had a lot of other people come and do. And that was something that was different for me.
Nice. And, you know, speaking of that new record, actually, Level Up, which will be out by the time people are hearing this, you recorded at least some of it in California.
Yeah, a lot.
A lot of it.
Yeah.
Why?
To get out of my comfort zone and bring something refreshing and new to me. You know what I mean? One thing they wanted me to get out there, Travis and everybody wanted me to get out there and start working with these more industry producers, like your Scott Storches and your Dem Joints and Mechanics and, you know, people like that, which is big, you know what I'm saying? Definitely love to do that, but I definitely think that we came upon and figured out something, too. Me taking myself out of my comfort zone and getting me out there in the industry where they're really doing it was the best thing that I think happened. So we went out there. I was out there for a week. And I just worked. You know what I mean? We worked. I think I was out there. I recorded like 4 songs with Scott. Recorded a couple songs with 808 Mafia, Purpose. So, I mean, when it was out there, I probably did like 6-7 records, I think, recorded out there. But I already had my beats. I got all my beats that I loved and everything. And then I came back. But, you know, when you out there, and I was inspired out there, too. I was inspired by the producers. I was inspired by some of the writers that I was with, like with Scott Storch, Goldie, and DB. DB's on the Whipping Up record and the Crushing record.
Right, he does the hooks on both of them,
You could tell when you see the motion in my ring. Took a lot of chopping just to get it like it. I can't wait no longer, I need you. Lately I've been crushing over you.
Just inspired, they inspired me, you know, how they wrote, how they did it, you know what I mean? Everybody, they just go, you know, it's just like, and it took me back. They helped me identify something that I've been doing. It's like, even if you don't have it already written, you just go in the booth and let the music take you there. And that's what they do. Like Goldie, she didn't even write. She just listened to it. It's a song that we did called Ransom that didn't make the album, but I was so inspired by how she did it because she just listened to it. And then she went in there and she mumbled a bunch of stuff. And then she was telling, she kept mumbling as he was playing the hook. She's like, okay, keep that part. Okay, keep that part, keep that part. And then when she got the segment situated where it's all still mumbles, there's no words, and she kept on, just stayed up in there, and then it just ended up turning into words. Oh. It just turned into words, and that was super dope, you know what I mean? It was just like, I love the work ethic of everybody out there and creative genius minds, you know, Scott Storch and all those guys. It was super dope.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Scott. He's someone who has quite a track record and obviously very interesting personal history.
Scott Storch began his career as the keyboardist in The Roots and really reached his stride in the mid-2000s when he produced huge hits for Fat Joe, 50 Cent, Beyonce, Chris Brown, Lil' Kim, and more. But along with those hits came a famously expensive cocaine habit. At its height, Storch spent about $30 million in just 6 months on partying, a private jet, a yacht, and nearly 20 luxury cars. He has had cycles of rehab, arrests, and bankruptcy, but now says he is clean except for an intense weed habit, and he's back to making music.
What was he like to hang out with, to work with?
Super dope, super cool, you know what I mean? We got there, I remember walking in, met Steve, you know, LaBelle. End up meeting him, so we sat down, and Scott wasn't there just yet. They played a bunch of beats for me, you know what I'm saying?
Steve LaBelle, who also has a history with Ruthless.
Steve LaBelle was the manager for Ruthless Records' biggest selling act, Bone Thugs and Harmony.
Yes. I assume you guys bonded over that?
Yes, I didn't know that at the time. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know at the time that I was signed with Ruthless either.
Oh.
So we talked, you know, we chopped it up, and then he left out the room. Then he came back and he was like, yo, you was signed with Ruthless? I was like, yeah, that was my first day. He's like, man, Tamika, that's family.
Tamika Woods Wright is the widow of Ruthless's founder, Eazy-E. She played a big part in running the label after Eazy's 1995 death.
So we got to talking about that, like Small World and everything like that. And so that was super dope.
Yeah.
Scott came in. He was like, Steve, you smoke weed? I'm like, oh, yeah. He went in there, got me a whole bunch of weed, and we just started smoking and vibing out to music.
Right.
I ended up picking like 4 records. They emailed me to them. I went in the other room and started writing. And then he started creating on the spot. And then I just started dropping. Like, I think the first day I got there, night before I left, I dropped like 2 records with him. You know what I'm saying? But he had sat there and did the thing. We chopped it up a little bit. He had some other obligations to do, so he ended up leaving. And I just stayed at his house in another room and just recorded. Came and did the same thing the next day. So
wow. It's a very different vibe than Malta Ben than the previous record, which, you know, had its up and sort of party elements, but also the overarching thing was you know, this family-based thing, tracing your mother's history.
Mom's from a little town called Malta Ben, right outside Kansas City. Historically, it's a segregated town. She was raised in the church, sung and played piano for the choir.
Why the sort of lighter tone this time out?
I wanted to have fun. I think that the last album was so serious and so deep. And it was therapy. I keep saying it was real therapy for me to, like you said, tracing everything from my history. My mother and my father, learning things, you know. I went to study, you know what I'm saying? Was talking to my mother a lot about different things that I never knew, you know what I mean? So that's something I wanted to do if it wasn't for this small little segregated town outside of Kansas City, then it wouldn't be no me. So it's like, I'm off to bed, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's why I did it. And I just wanted to have fun this time. I didn't want to think. I just wanted to go and just have fun and do music, you know what I mean? And they put me with a bunch of dope producers and able to get a super current sound and just let the music and the vibe take us. And that's what we did. Didn't question anything. Just came in and just had fun.
Nice. And, you know, something I was wondering about, you said, you know, you started out producing just as much as rapping.
Yes.
And now for at least your career on Strange, you haven't been at least credited as a producer.
No.
How involved are you in the musical side of what you do?
Heavily involved in everything. Even when it comes down to sequencing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I haven't actually produced anything for myself in a long, long, long time. But I'm definitely still, like, I'll go to 7 and be like, okay, this is what I want.
That's Strange Music in-house producer Michael 7 Summers.
Give him my idea, do it, and then I still rearrange. You know what I'm saying? I'll still go up there and do my sequencing like I feel, take the hi-hats here and do like that. And realistically, I could get credit for that, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't care. It's like give it all the way to the producer.
Right.
And everything like that, so.
Crazy. And Malta Bend, you said the first time you went there was a video shoot.
Photo shoot.
So you'd already written and recorded a whole album about this place without having been there.
Yes.
Wow. How did the actual Malta Bend match up to the place in your head?
I thought it was bigger. I knew it was small. I didn't know it was like three blocks, though. You know what I mean? But, you know, and that was great for me and my mom, too, to get her. And she took me down there with the whole crew and everything. This was like during segregation. My mother was alive and was there. So there was a thing called Upper Town and Lower Town. So the white people lived in Upper Town.
Usually how that goes.
Yeah, and the black people lived in Lower Town.
Yeah.
Now, she was a part of that, but then she was also part of when they was able to, you know what I'm saying, come together, of course, too. So when she was telling me Upper Town and Lower Town, I'm like, okay. So I'm thinking I'm about to see, like, a vast difference or something. Mm-hmm. It was literally a block away from each other. Like, she's like, yeah, this is Upper Town right here. I'm like, okay. She's like, Lower Town's down there. I'm like, okay, let's hop in the car. She was like, nah, we can just walk. I'm like, huh? She's like, yeah, you see the blue building right there? That's Lower Town. So it was so crazy. It was the old, what's it called, AFW building, like a bingo hall. Mm-hmm. But the land that their house was on, my grandmother's house, we was walking in the living room, you know what I mean? It's literally just like right down the street, like no far from here to maybe that building across the street, you know what I'm saying? From Upper Town to Lower Town, it's just like literally right there. And another thing that was super dope, Malta Bend's named after a steamboat that sunk in the Missouri River. And it's like three sides of this place is surrounded by the Missouri River, and the steamboat Malta sunk, never was able to find it, right? The time that we're down there doing the photo shoot, they just found it. Uh-huh. So you got all these reporters and everybody there that's actually, you know what I'm saying, they digging it up and everything like that.
A steamboat called the Malta. In 1841, the steamboat hit a tree snag and sank in less than a minute. Everybody got off safely, but there was no time to retrieve anything on board. The town was named after the bend in the river where the steamboat Malta sank, untouched until now.
Well, those two old trees are. That's where the river was then.
It's north of town, but south of the winding river we meet.
So I thought that was pretty cool, and just peeping the history of Malta Bend. No gas stations, no grocery stores, no nothing.
And so when your family finally heard Malta Bend, particularly the title track and the interludes and stuff like that, how did they react?
They was emotional. Especially my mother, you know what I'm saying? But they loved it, especially, you know, they know we're going to party and everything. But when it got to the songs like Malta Bend and My Legacy and Ambition and Motivation.
Singing out the night, remembering them Malta Bend memories. Oh, Lord, unleash these words. Not it's meant to be. This legacy.
Follow me from the middle of the map to the top. Tell me what you call that. Ambition and motivation to the ceiling.
Those are the records that really, really touch. They hit home. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Those are the ones sort of toward the end when the album takes even more of kind of a serious turn.
Definitely.
My Legacy, actually, I wanted to ask about that because that has the big gospel section at the end.
Yes.
And as someone who grew up in the church,
yes.
What was it like for you to kind of recreate that on one of your albums, that sound?
Wonderful, wonderful. We knew that we wanted to do it. Me and Seven came up. Seven did the beat. We knew what we wanted to do. And there's a guy named Isaac Cates, who's a gospel piano player. He has a church called Ordained. They're right there in Kansas City. And Tech N9ne had been using them a lot. And I just loved what they brought to the table. So we brought Isaac Cates to come in. And then he rewrote that whole part on that part. So me and Seven did the first part, then he rewrote when it shifts up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was so beautiful. And, you know, just hit, like I said, it just hit the roots on everything that I came from. So
nice.
It was...
Who did the singing on it?
She was a lady that also... Chris Calico clicked me up with her. I don't think she's a part of Ordained... but they all still sung together. Mm-hmm. So everybody's from Kansas City that's actually on it. Isaac Cate, he rewrote it. He's the piano. He did the shift.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. And then there, you know, with the Martha Ben, you know, we got all the narration that's done.
Mm-hmm.
That's Isaac Cates playing the piano behind that too. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? So I end up using Isaac throughout the whole album. Nice. On that one.
So you're on the road right now?
Yes.
With Tech?
Yes.
But you were also a part of this insane tour that hit 93 shows in 105 days.
Definitely.
Which I can't even, as someone who's done my fair share of touring, I can't even imagine. What were your best tricks for not dying during that tour?
Oh, man. I don't know how I made it. To be honest with you. I mean, you just can't party every single night. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You got to take care of your body. You got to take care of your vocals. And there was like some stretches, like 28 shows. I remember there's 28 shows in a row and certain things like that. We made hip hop history. I love it. Love to be a part of that. I can't say I'll never do it again. I don't think I want to. You know what I mean? And a good thing that I didn't have I wasn't in a relationship at the time, because being gone 3 months.
Right.
Got to be super, super hard.
Yeah. How long did you sleep for when you finally got home?
Oh, man. A couple weeks, probably. I didn't do anything for like a couple of weeks. Like, sat back and just relaxed. Just phone off.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Was it on that tour, or was it a later tour you had an incident happen where your friend Michael got killed?
Ooh, that was on the Sixes and
Sevens.
That was
Sixes and Sevens tour, different tour.
Yeah.
You obviously ended up writing a very moving song about that and putting together a very moving tribute song on which you have a verse.
Life is the road, and my vision is clearer. Reminiscing about Michael Jones as I look in the mirror. Thinking about you, and I know that you hear it. Gone in the flesh, but I feel you in spirit.
Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, we was in Reno and did the show. The bus was a little loud, and you know, there's people on the bus and everybody was partying and everything. And MJ just got off the bus to talk to his wife. He didn't, you know, of course, didn't want to talk around with everybody. He was a little bit away from the bus, and some guys came up and started some stuff with him and shot him, you know, like six or seven times, I can't remember which one, but he actually survived that, and he ended up dying 14 days later from a blood clot. You know what I mean? Very sad, very, very sad, unfortunate.
And what was putting that song together, getting all the performances, getting everyone together, and writing your part, what was that like? What did that kind of do for your process of mourning him?
You know, yeah, that's a tough one, man. You know, just to make sure his legacy lives on, you know.
On a lighter note.
Yeah.
Tell me about meeting Don King.
Don King, wow. How'd you find that out?
You know, we have our ways.
Okay. I actually was at like a Nelly black and white ball.
Mm-hmm.
Nelly had a black and white ball in St. Louis. I don't think I even had no deal yet. I was just, this part time, I was just grinding and working and everything. I went to the black and white ball, and that's where I met him. It was short and sweet.
Right.
It was cool to meet Don King.
It seems pretty memorable. He said he's wearing an American flag shirt.
Yes, American flag shirt with the American flag. Like, God bless America. That's what he was really saying. Everything he was saying was like all about America, you know. I'll never forget. It was like a jean jacket with the American flag shirt,
mm-hmm,
with the actual flag in the same.
Wow. One thing I wanted to get into with you for a second was you mentioned, you know, we had Shorty Red, the producer, on not long ago.
Okay.
And he's obviously a big proponent of the 808 that is core to his sound and to trap, the
yeah,
style he helped invent. You shout out the 808 on a bunch of your songs, including 808 Bendin'.
Yes.
What does that machine mean to you?
Well, it's a sound. to me. You know, 808 is an actual sound. I know there's an 808 machine also, but when I'm talking about that, I'm just talking about the bass and how it's bending. Boom, boom, boom. That's an 808 sound. You know what I'm saying? It's the punch, it's the pulse. You know, anybody that knows me, they know I love bass. I love heavy drums. That's what moves me. If it doesn't have that, then usually I'm not going to feel it. I'm like, I can't feel it without the, I need to, you know. It's crazy. I've always wanted a Shorty Red beat, too. I think I almost got one like one time, but yeah, you got to click me up with him.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. He is a friend of the show.
Not forgotten, we actually tweeted at Shorty Red right when he said this during the show, and Shorty replied, so maybe it'll happen.
You know, rapping-wise, an inspiration for you, you've said, and I don't know if this is just because of similarities in your voice or because of any sort of stylistic thing, was Mystical.
Yeah, Mystical.
Yeah. Can you talk about that for a second?
Oh, man. I just, No Limit Soldiers. Mm-hmm. Master P. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what, we grew up listening to that.
Yeah.
You know, I loved his, on the No Limit Soldier, you know, everybody loved what they brought to the table. It was just like, and then, and where I was, they was dominating, you know what I mean? But Mystical, I just took to him a lot. I loved how he came across on the track, yeah, snapping, you know what I'm saying?
Coming back, more fearless, more determined, and focused set. I ain't even started yet, so if you ain't ready, you better get ready. No, I do it better when I'm being opposed.
You don't hear a lot of people take direct influence from him because his style is so individual and so kind of all over the place.
Yes.
Really interesting.
So it was definitely a blessing and for me to be able to actually get a record with him on that Malta Ben album too. Rain Dance.
I'ma come around, better make a rain dance. Yikes, I know what she like. Pipe, I be laying it right. She said it's tight, and she wanted with Mike. I'm finna be pelling in that pussy like I'm riding a bike. And we lead a strip club.
Me, him, and Tech did that. And once again, the native side, you know, taking the roots and everything. And we just happened to get him on it, which was a beautiful thing. That was a blessing.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of influences, you mentioned your father is a bishop.
Yes.
Do you see any similarities between, I assume he would preach?
Oh, yeah.
Any similarities between how he preached and, and how you rap?
Everybody, like my brothers and my family, they come and see me doing it. It's like, boy, you sound just like your daddy. You know, my daddy had a raspy voice. He commanded when he listened. I mean, when he talked, you would listen. You know what I'm saying? He was a great speaker, very, very great speaker. So I take after him, I think, a whole lot. Definitely my persona on the stage to command attention while I'm on there. Definitely get that from my father. Definitely.
And I have to ask, I see it tattooed on your arms here, your catchphrase.
Himmeheim,
what is it? Where'd it come from?
Man, Himmeheim was, it started off as a joke. We'd get on the school bus, and before we started rapping and doing our thing on the way to school, I would always say, Himmeheim, and everybody would just laugh at it. But then we would just start beatboxing and partying and everything.
So it was just kind of a random, funny sounding
random
thing.
It just sounded funny. I don't know where it came from. It just came out of my head, Himmeheim, one day, and I start saying it. Kept saying it. Next thing you know, I did a song in the garage. It was called Let Us In. It's one of my first records that I ever recorded. It's called Let Us In. I produced the beat. This is the beat that I produced when they said do something on the TS-10 that I told you about earlier.
Yeah.
So I produced this beat, and at the beginning of it, I said, Himmeheim. What y'all niggas know about that? Shimmy Shump Jump. Himmeheim Heim. It was random.
Right.
It was crazy, but it stuck. So when people, when the song came, the song was dope. Of course, 808 driven. So the song in the town in Columbia, it was like a, it was a little smash for the town. You know, it didn't get out of Columbia, but everybody in the town was digging it. And they couldn't get off the Himmeheim. Like, what is that? And I'm like, I don't know. And then one of the OGs was just like, you got to make a, that's you. You got to go ahead and make it, you got to make it something. So that's when I did anything that's Himmy. Himmy could be a person, place, a thing. It's a reaction, but it's also call and response. If you feel me, then you say Heim. So that's where Himmeheim.
So you're from Missouri, obviously, and you lived in St. Louis for a long time. To get a little serious for a second, before things really went down there, did you have, what did you think about Ferguson? Had you ever been there? Was that in your head as like a place? Like what did you think of it?
What do I think about
it? What did you think of it before the Michael Brown incident? Like, you had Ferguson filed in your head.
Right. I mean, the same thing that you see on TV that is like, you know, it ain't always, it's fucked up.
It had that reputation before.
Yeah. Fucked up. You know what I'm saying? Police will fuck with you. Driving, you get pulled over, what y'all doing? You got some drugs on, you know what I'm saying? All that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's like, you know, profiling, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? It goes down there, you know what I mean? But it's been going down there for years and years and years, you know what I'm saying? Me and my guy Frizz was talking about it when his grandmother, years and years and years ago, she went through that, you know what I'm saying? So you're talking about decades.
Yeah.
It's just now the internet is, and there's videotape, and people can record it now when you start to see it. But that stuff has been happening longer than, way older than me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You were out of town when Michael Brown
happened. I was. I was just did a show in Albuquerque, I believe. And we heard about some it going on. You know what I'm saying? What was going on. But when we came into town, as soon as we pull in, we turn on the, just get in the St. Louis, put it on 104. And we hear, I can just hear like the DJs like, no, stop it. Don't do it. They pleading to the people to don't loot, to don't do this and everything. And I finally make it to the house and chaos on the TV. You know what I'm saying? So super crazy. Super crazy.
I can imagine. Did you know people who live there?
That have lived there. Nobody that was living in that area at that time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do want to say this.
Of course.
When you see what you were seeing on TV, I remember it looking like St. Louis was burning down.
Mm-hmm.
wasn't the case. It was like a block or two. Maybe not even two blocks. It was like one block that everything was going on. It wasn't that big of a joint where you seen all the looting and all the stuff that was going on. So it didn't happen all over the city. It happened in one small section. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wanted to go ahead and say that.
Yeah. And finally, you know, going through your catalog, I noticed that you have probably more songs with Chris Calico than anyone else.
Some try to hold me down.
Yeah.
Other people said that I was crazy. Been working to get my feet off the ground. Now, I told them I was going around. And she'd be coming right back. She'd be coming right back. Baby, turn around. She'd come right back for the home around.
Come from anyway. Think I could die there any day. I ain't hood, but I keep my finger on the trigger. Songs is good, but I think different than them other niggas.
So what comes out of my... Tell me a little bit about your chemistry, why you work so well together.
Word. I didn't even know that was the case, but me and Calico just do dope music together. You know what I'm saying? My brother. We both like to sing and harmonize and rap and, you know what I'm saying, and everything. So it's always dope getting in, bumping heads with, you know, him. He's a genius, super talented, you know what I'm saying? So now that you mention it, yeah, me and Calico got a lot
of them. Yeah, you got a lot of them.
We always have a lot of them, you know what I'm saying? Like, he's definitely probably always a couple of my records on every album.
Mm-hmm.
Even this new album, I think I got him on two records. You know, he's a dope writer, too. You know what I'm saying? So I just always like to work with him and vibe with him and feed off his energy and everything because the guy understands music.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? He understands music, and that's big bro.
Yeah. So what's going on? You got the tour right now.
Yes.
Level Up's coming out
June 2nd.
June 2nd. Yes, so what's going on?
Oh, man, the tour is doing good. Spreading the word. You know, I am performing one record on this tour, which is Options, produced by 808 Mafia.
It don't matter when the bass get the dropping, that's the name, knocking, hoes get the popping, man, that boy got options. When the bass gets the dropping, yeah, that's the name, knocking.
So I've been doing that, the crowd's taking over, really, really dope, you know what I'm saying? We're just having fun, man. Just like I did with the album, you know. Let's have fun, up and up, and you know what I'm saying? Let it go up.
Sounds like a great note to end on. Stevie Stone, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
When I first sat down with Stevie, I didn't know exactly what to expect.
We've had lots of strange music artists on the show over the years, but I had only met Stevie very briefly prior to this taping. I was so glad when he turned out to be thoughtful about his work and career choices, funny, and, as you heard, very emotionally honest about both his triumphs and his losses. From his time at Ruthless to his relationship with Tech N9ne to how he confronted his own family history on his Malta Bend album, we covered a whole lot of ground in this interview. Even if you were unfamiliar with Stevie's music before, I think you now have a pretty good sense of his work ethic, his attention to craft, and his willingness to go to unexplored places. Join us next week when our guest will be director Ernest Dickerson as we discuss the upcoming 25th anniversary Blu-ray of his classic movie Juice. The Blu-ray is out today, June 5th, and features a bunch of amazing bonus material, including a never-before-seen alternate ending. But that's not all we'll be talking to Ernest about. We'll discuss his longtime relationship with Spike Lee, how he directed Snoop Dogg and Jada Pinkett Smith in horror movies, and, of course, the iconic episodes of The Wire that he helmed. Join us next week in Amsterdam. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you liked this episode, you should listen to our talk with Stevie Stone's strange music pal Chris Calico on episode 153. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's Podcasts, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just $1 a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Join us by the end of June to have access to July's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of the Wu-Tang Clan and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cipher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Gave me a whole bunch of weed, and we just start smoking.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I learned my math off of you.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I mean, I love to write hooks.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Young. I just see young.
Our audio assistant is Rob Van Vranken.
Like, we didn't even ask him.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Tim O'Rourke.
Send me some more.
And extra special thanks to our good friend Richie Abbott for making this episode happen.
Damn, I've never drank wine before.
We'll see you next time around on The Cipher.
Hell yeah, man.